Saybrook's Department of Integrative Social Work is committed to preparing outstanding social work professionals who will serve as inspirational leaders, change agents, and teachers in public health, healthcare, the corporate world, and academia. Prepare to advance your career within the professional field of social work and leverage your expertise to initiate transformational change in organizations and communities toward a more just, humane, and sustainable world. Learn more at saybrook.edu. Today's episode of Saybrook Insights is a rebroadcast of our Women in Mental Health panel presentation hosted by the Divisions of Student Affairs and University Relations. We were pleased to have a candid discussion surrounding the challenges, stigmas, and potential solutions with these leaders who serve in very different capacities across the mental health landscape. Our facilitator is Saybrook faculty member Dr. Walker Ladd, and our panelists included Shayla Betts, LCSW, Dr. Kelly Serafini, Dr. Elizabeth Miller, and Saybrook's new Dean of the College of Social Sciences, Dr. Charlotte Hamilton. Enjoy this robust discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Women in Mental Health. This is our panel of dynamic women discussing the stigma, challenges, and solutions surrounding mental health. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our illustrious facilitator is Dr. Walker Ladd, and I will hand over the floor to Dr. Ladd so she can tell you a little about herself. Take it away, Dr. Ladd.
Well, welcome everyone to this important conversation. And I will share that I'm delighted to be featuring the lovely voices that are on the call today. My name is Walker Ladd, and I am a faculty in the Department of Research. But in my other life, I do research about stigma and stigma mental illness, particularly for the perinatal population. My own research is in the area of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. And my background is clinical psych. And I'm here to introduce you to the other amazing women. We're going to be talking about what it's like in the profession, and then we'll talk a little bit, we'll get the different perspectives as to issues that we see women in our communities dealing with, and then we'll leave a good chunk of time for you to ask the panel great questions. So with that, I would like to introduce, first of all, Dr. Charlotte Hamilton. Charlotte, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Ladd. I am Charlotte Hamilton. I am so super happy to be here today, and especially in honor of Women's Month and all that we are doing. It's just wonderful to be here. It's just wonderful to see everyone too. I am just coming aboard as the Dean of the College of Social Sciences at Saybrook University. And the last 20 years, I have been a counselor, educator, and a practitioner. And my specialty, I guess I could say specialty, I'm still learning and still growing, but it's in the area of children and adolescents and working with younger adults with drug and alcohol issues and also some behavior and trauma issues. So again, thank you all for coming, and it's great to see you all and to be here today.
Thank you. Next, let's Dr. Serafini, would you like to share your background with us?
Yeah. Hi, it's nice to see everybody. My name is Kelly Serafini. I am a clinical psychologist and a licensed substance use disorder professional living in Washington State. I'm faculty in the clinical psychology program, and I've been with Saybrook, I think it's going on year 5, which has been a wonderful community. And some of my research and clinical interests have been primarily in addictions, integrated primary care and health psychology, Latinx mental health, transgender mental health, and adolescent health. Thank you.
Thank you. And next, I think we will ask Dr. Miller, the newly minted Dr. Miller, to introduce herself, Elizabeth Miller. And Elizabeth,
hey, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks, Dr. Ladd, for the introduction. Yes, I am a previous graduated Saybrook student. I graduated with my PhD in mind-body medicine from Saybrook recently. But prior to that, I began my undergraduate, I started in really becoming interested in human sciences and moved into becoming a licensed professional counselor. And what I do now is I am an integrative psychotherapist in the Houston area in private practice. And my focus primarily is working with women's health and chronic illness and trauma. And so a majority of my clients fall into the realm of maternal health, and they are suffering from either a mood disorder related to maternal health or have suffered maybe some birth trauma or preparing for labor and delivery. I'm a qualitative researcher, and my research has been focused in the realm of maternal health, but more specifically, hypnosis-assisted birth.
Thank you. And last but not least, I would like to introduce Shayla. Shayla Betts, would you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes. Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. I am Shayla Betts. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Virginia. I have been a social worker for the past about 7 years now. And so a lot of my experience is working with children, families, and then more recently with the adult population as an outpatient therapist. So I am a current student at Saybrook University. I do a lot of work with race relations and racial justice and looking at that intersectionality piece, especially in my clinical practice of the intersectional identities of race and gender and what that means and what impact that has on mental health.
Ah, I'm amazed, and it's so great. I'm looking at all of the amazing names and faces here and a celebration of women that we so need. And I thought that I would, before we turn it over to some ideas about what it's like to be in the profession, I just wanted to share a few statistics. So, according to CDC, in the year 2019, 1 in 5 U.S. adults lived with a mental illness. So that's roughly 51.5 million people, adults. Here's the important part. Of that group, only 44.8% got treatment. And of that group, of that 51 million, more females received mental health services than males, but only 49% of us reached out for help. And this is for all mental illnesses, not even narrowing it down to severe mental illness. And of that group, all mental illness and women, those aged years 26 to 49 had the highest prevalence with 45%. So just to give us some context as to mental illness in this topic, I often wonder why we have to call it mental health when we're talking about mental illness. So that's an area of stigma that we could talk about in the future. Questions. My first question for the panel, and feel free to jump in, guys, is what is it like to be a woman in the field of mental health? I see the
yes,
knowledge.
I'll jump in and
jump in.
So if you remember in my introduction, I really focused on that intersectional lens. And so my response will be what is it like to be a woman in mental health, but what does it mean to be a Black female therapist? And that has a whole new meaning from my experience of it. When I first started as an outpatient therapist, my focus was on adolescents, young adults, and the adult population. And I very quickly saw that my need was to really focus on providing mental health supports to women who identify with as a person of color. And when I really put out that focus within maybe a matter of weeks, I then had a wait list. Because the number of women of color who are providing mental health intervention is so few. And there are a lot of cultural implications for why that is and different cultural beliefs. But for me, as a Black female therapist, that has had added weight. And I make it a purpose, and because that is my specialty, to think about how do these social identities impact our mental health, not just mental illness, but mental health. And so, of course, the difference is mental health is everybody has it, right? Just like everybody has a physical health. It is our mental functioning. It is our well-being, right? And mental illness is just one piece of our mental health. But it's very important for me and my work to think about what impact does social identity and the stigma and stereotypes associated with that and the weight that we, many of us carry because of our social identities and the ways that we have been oppressed or disadvantaged. What are the implications of that on our mental health? And how does that potentially contribute to mental illness? And so my experience is, of course, with social work, we had that use of self, right? And so how do I use my experience as a Black woman to further connect with other women of color? To relate to their stories, but also in that professional sense to understand what are the needs of this community and how can I provide intervention to address these ways in ways that other people may not. And so that's just kind of been a little bit of my insight into my approach as a clinician of color, female clinician of color.
Thank you, Shayla. Others?
And I am really happy that Shayla said that because I, as a woman, I agree. As a woman of color, I think if you look at it from that point of view in counseling, it's not only hard in a sense that some cultures and some people of color may have a stigma on mental health and mental illnesses. So it's nice to hear, Shayla, that when you put that out there, that you had a waiting list, because it's so important for everyone to be able to seek therapy, seek help, and seek assistance, no matter who they are. But we do know that there is great amount of stigma in the community. And I think one of the reasons why I appreciate being a woman of color in counseling is because I can relate to people who may not relate to others. And I also enjoy that because I want people to feel comfortable coming to me, coming to learn, coming to grow. And so it's really important for me. It's very, very important. And I started off with young adults and ended up with adults. And then I went back to young adults because I just believe, you know, I believe that we can catch them while they're young. We can help them. There's always hope. And I like that. So for me, it's been inspiring because I choose to live like that. And I choose to share that with my clients, with my students, and with people I know in my life.
So Dr. Serafini, Kelly, what is it like to be a woman in the field of mental health?
Yeah, I just want to appreciate the question because it's like, where do you even begin?
I know.
like applying for grad school, deciding to go to post-grad, to go into clinical work or research or academia. And there's just a lot to unpack. For me, I will start by saying from a place of gratitude, I'm so grateful for this profession. It's been a real privilege to be able to work and partner and collaborate with clients and with colleagues around health and wellness. And for me, I think one of the bigger picture things that I've appreciated is that it's a flexible career. For me as a clinical psychologist, there's kind of three career paths or integration of career paths, whether it's clinical practice or research and teaching. And that flexibility, as I was in different stages of my career, from early career to motherhood, I have a toddler daughter, to, you know, looking for a new employment across the country. has been really helpful. So I've had positions where I've done 100% clinical work. I've done positions where it's been 100% research or 100% teaching or 50-50 or 25-75. And so there's been that flexibility to be able to piece together a career that fits with where I'm at in terms of my life. So that's something that I've really been grateful for.
Ah, thank you. The profession across the lifespan, without a doubt. I was just realizing that I'm the facilitator, but I'm also the oldest person, so I can speak to the experience as the grand dame of the group. I do want to ask Elizabeth, you're an early career professional. What has your experience been as a woman in this profession?
So I really love everyone's answers because I find part of my story within each of them. But for me, I started as an LPC and an LCDC, so licensed professional counselor and working in clinical addiction and things like that in the emergency psych side of things. And so I started my career heavy in the allopathic mental illness world. And I had a lot of exposure into psychiatric hospitals and things like that. And so for me, starting in that realm, my personal experience was I was one of few women that were part of the team. So beginning in the psych hospitals, many of the psychiatrists and even the therapists and even the intake professionals were all men. And so I remember going to one of my first jobs and being the only woman professional. And coming in and out were different male psychiatrists and things like that. And so that was a really interesting experience for me. Something that I also picked up on early in my career is that many of the clientele were women. And when I was working as a therapist, a lot of the women were coming to me and saying things like, you know, I wish there were more women psychiatrists. I wish there were more women therapists that I could see and things like that. And so for me, in the beginning of my career, I guess that was about 10 years ago now, I felt really empowered and I felt like I had a space to create what I could bring to the table. And so ever since then, I've really tried to work on that. I've tried to own my own little piece of this work, which for me really has evolved, just like all the other women have said. For me, it started working with women and men in addiction recovery in an emergency psych and has now morphed into maternal health and chronic illness, because I became a mother and I experienced firsthand the difficulty of trying to find healthcare and mental health care being a woman. And so for me, I think one of the biggest challenges or one of the biggest things that I have loved about being a woman in mental health has been the sense of community. I have since created a community here in Houston of one and beyond, now that we're so virtual, of wonderful women working in the field of mental health. And particularly you, Dr. Ladd, working in maternal health, I have found my niche within that little community as well. And so I think something beautiful about being a woman in mental health is that we do want community and we do want to support each other and we do want to lift each other up and share each other's voices. And so for me, that's been the most special part of what I do besides working directly with clients. But I think the downside or the biggest challenge that I have experienced, especially in the Houston area, is that there are not enough women who are available to see women who are suffering from maternal mental illness, particularly in the realm of trying to conceive all the way through pregnancy, helping women prepare for pregnancy, labor, delivery, and then also postpartum. So I think we lack clinicians that do specialize in this. And that is oftentimes the feedback that I get when women end up coming to me, that I just couldn't find anyone that really knew what it was like or really had an understanding of what I went through with my birth trauma or things like that.
So true. And Elizabeth, you're bringing up part of, you know, the realm of challenges that we see women in our communities, in our world deal with. And I am not a clinician. I was, and then had my son. And that precipitated my interest in finding community that would advocate for maternal mental health. So I became a researcher, and everything you guys are sharing really resonates with me, because I am very grateful, like Kelly was saying, for the community, but it's small still, and I'm at a wonderful institution, but I don't necessarily have as many relationships with fellow researchers who are researching in this area. And that's a challenge. So finding collaboration across other programs is something that I'm hoping to be able to have, because you are correct that we're really underrepresented in psychiatry, that's for sure, but in research, and in research about women and about women's mental health across a lifespan. So that's definitely one of the challenges I have, is kind of working by myself. And things like this that we're doing today are ways of reaching out and pulling in students that I know who are also working to advance these issues is so important to what I like to do. Kelly, you look like you wanted to share something.
Oh, I was just nodding because I understand the isolation. And previously to coming to Saybrook, I was doing my postdoc in an R1 institution and the culture of just high stakes academia of, having not that many female mentors, it can be really difficult. So I'm just yes nodding to all that you're saying.
For the panel, what are some of the specific challenges that you're seeing your populations, the women in your communities or in your client list deal with? What's happening right now?
I would say that what's happening right now is the superwoman complex. I have to say that because it's not, absolutely, it's not just with clients, but it's with peers, it's with colleagues, it's with family members. We all know a woman who's a mom, who's also working, who's also in a relationship or has a partner, but also maybe in that sandwich crunch like I am, and helping my elderly parents or another loved one. And you're doing this and you're doing it all, and no one's checking in on you saying, how are you doing with this mentally? What are you doing for yourself? You're taking care of your children. You're taking care of your partner. You're taking care of an elderly loved one or a person who needs caregiving. What are you doing for yourself? And then not to mention the work that you're doing. So I think that superwoman complex is something that we deal with, and sometimes we don't even know we deal with it. We just do it. I can say for me, I've done that when my father was ill 3 years ago, and helping my family members and working with my children and my partner. It was a lot, but I had no idea what I was doing. I was just doing it until I felt really bad, and I had to take a look at how I'm taking care of myself. But I know so many people, so many women, especially in this profession, we preach and we talk about self-care all the time. We give recommendations to people about self-care all the time, but it's sometimes missing in the work that we do for ourselves. And to me, that's a really big struggle. The other part of being a superwoman is just the guilt of having to do everything and not being able to do it all, or not being able to do it well, because sometimes you just can't turn something in on time. You can't do your 100% best because you're doing so many other things. So I think that complex is real. I think that it is definitely a limitation to what women do and who we are in our work and who we are in our families, because it does not teach our children and it doesn't set a great example. It set examples, but I think when we talk about healthy examples, it may not be as healthy as we want it to be when we are showing them that we're trying to take care of every single thing and we're not taking care of ourselves. So I would say that, Dr.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I feel a collective, everyone in this call is nodding over that, those comments, and my goodness, what you shared about the feeling, never quite feeling done or never quite feeling like you've done it well. And the kinds of examples that we set for ourselves and for our peers, for our students, it's definitely a challenge. I'm wondering, Shayla,
yeah, I would, Dr. Hamilton, I was nodding, like you took the words out for me. And when you said a thing about self-care, I'm just like, yeah, I know you're speaking to me now too. but the one thing I will add, in addition to, you know, needing to be this heroine and this superhero, is that the guilt and shame that I've seen so many women carry when they have very understandable trauma, as if they aren't allowed to feel that, or shouldn't be burdened by it, or I feel so silly to come for coming to therapy for this, or but it is. And I say, well, why? Right? I said, it's hard. And so one thing that I've noticed with my clients, but then also I'm also a professor, a social work professor. So I've seen my students just feel like, oh, well, it could be so much worse. And I say, yes. But then I give that analogy of, you know, if I have a really bad accident, say I have a really bad fall and I break my arm in two or three different places, that's going to hurt a lot. And I'm going to be crying and I'm going to be a really hard patient. I'm going to go to a hospital and say, I broke my arm. I need help. And maybe as I'm receiving that medical attention, I might turn next to me and see somebody have this really devastating car accident, or maybe they are in a full body cast. And I say, oh my goodness, that's really bad. That is worse. But does that mean that my arm does not hurt? No, I'm still in pain. I still may need surgery. I still may need a cast. And I put that in perspective for any client, really, but especially women, in terms of, if you have a harm that you are experiencing, it is expected that you would feel pain. And we want to sit in that pain. We want to validate it. We want to acknowledge that it's there, so we can process it and continue in that healing process, so it does not become debilitating, right, or disabling. So in addition to feeling like I have to do it all, I'm this superhero, this is what's expected of me, we hold that, but then we also hold, you know, some of these traumas, whether it's a broken heart or a sexual trauma or abuse. And what are we experiencing? And why do we feel like that's just a day in the life? And so really challenging some of those stigmas and stereotypes in terms of what is that we're expected to carry and how, and being able to give voice to that and to tell our story, like, yes, I can be strong, but this still happened. And so you can both be strong and be a superhero and still need that help and support without shaming or blaming yourself. So how do we start with giving ourselves that grace first? Because we can't always expect it to come from society. We got to learn to do it for ourselves. And when we carry that energy within us, it not only heals us, but it makes us more available for the next person. And so that's something that I also, you know, really focus on in my practice.
Thank you, Shayla. Kelly, what are some of the challenges that you see the women in that you're working with?
Well, just going off of the conversation so far, I mean, it resonates so deeply, because I think in society, there's this expectation, and certainly I can speak for myself, the personal expectation of, I have to have a job as if I'm not a mom, and I have to be a mom as if I don't have a job. And just the impossibleness of that situation. really resonates. I think in the clinical work that I've done, some of the biggest challenges have been access to treatment, which goes to what you're saying, Dr. Ladd, around where so many women aren't receiving any care at all. And I think it's really, you know, multi-systemic. I think part of that is insurance coverage. Women are less likely to have employer-based health insurance. There's, I think, certainly a need for universal health care so that all women can have access to mental health care. I think there's childcare restraints where, okay, they only have an appointment at this time, but my kids are off school or I have an infant. I think there's conversations with clients around children of, is it okay to bring my baby to session or is it okay to bring my three-year-old to session? There's no one to watch them. And then what's appropriate to discuss during those types of sessions, right? So that we're not talking about perhaps sexual trauma, right? During a session like that, that wouldn't be appropriate for a kiddo to hear. I think there's transportation restraints. So just again, kind of speaking to what you were saying, there's a lot that women are juggling. And I think we need to do a better job as a profession of meeting women where they're at. How can we access them to provide them more flexible mental health care? And I do think that part of this last year or so with the pandemic, with having more providers doing telehealth is a step forward to reaching more people, but I still think we have a long ways to go.
And before, Elizabeth, before I turn to you, just to, because it's come up, just to give a context to the kinds of issues that a few of you have talked about, according to the World Health Organization, an estimated 80% of 50 million people affected by violent crimes, civil wars, disasters, and displacement globally are women and children. So the women coming to us or trying to learn about how to be a part of this profession globally, at least one in five women suffer rape or attempted rape. So these, as Shayla was saying, these historical traumas, intergenerational traumas, trying to hold that space and put on a good front in academia or put on a good front on a speaker panel for your organization. Yes, creating some space for each other to be a little bit more authentic and self-help, definitely. And I'm thinking about Dr. Miller, who I shared with the panelists before this call, when she defended her proposal, I had the good fortune and honor of being her chair. When she defended her proposal, she was in early labor with her second child and on a birth ball. And so, Elizabeth, in your area, what are some of the unique challenges that you find your clients dealing with?
Well, I first want to acknowledge and thank you for always holding space for me, no matter where I'm at in my journey of becoming a mother, because I don't think in most PhD programs there would have been space for that. Hmm. And I want to acknowledge that. And I just want to thank you for being there for me always. I feel really honored that I got to go through a program where women were supported. I felt very supported in my program. From the women that surrounded me. And I think that is a minority from everything that I've heard from other programs. To encapsulate what everyone has said, I think there is this idea for women that if we are surviving, we are thriving. And I think that just encompasses all of it, whether we're a mental health professional, whether we are a client. We all wear so many hats. None of us are just one thing. I've never met a woman that's just one thing. And I think going deeper into my realm of work is the idea that my belief system, I guess, is that we're not put on this planet to survive. We're put on this planet to survive. And in order to survive, we need community. We need herd, and we need to have our experiences shared with others and really respected and cared for in a way that I think right now in our culture we are lacking. And so my research specifically was the lived experience of hypnosis-assisted birth, I found it very important to bring light to women's voices. I think one of the biggest challenges, you know, the biggest concerns that I hear over and over and over in my clinical practice are two things: that the women don't feel supported in their community, whether that's because they haven't tapped into it enough or whether they just are living in silo, going to work, they're busy professionals, coming home and parenting and going to bed and starting all over the next day. Maybe they lack community. But the other thing that I hear specifically from the women that I work with who have experienced birth trauma or are preparing for the birth of their desired birth is that they don't feel heard. They don't feel heard in by their doctors. They don't feel heard after birth. Right now in our culture, if women choose to give birth in a hospital setting, they go for their ultrasounds, their 10-minute ultrasound meetings, and they give birth and then they leave and they come back for a 6-week appointment. And oftentimes are never even asked about clinical symptoms related to mental illness. And so in my practice, I often see women who have suffered for many years since delivering or going through pregnancy or going through the transition into motherhood. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that we are not giving enough. One of the biggest challenges is that women are suffering alone, and we have not had enough voice yet to really bring attention to the stigma around women's mental health, especially in the realm of the perinatal period. And so my hope is that through my work, my research, my clinical practice, I can fight for women and bring light to some of these issues. But I do think there are many concerns in the way that we treat women, especially in the maternal health world.
Thank you. You know, the idea of stigma formation, everyone has so far on the panel has touched on it. And stigma formation, meaning that there's this tendency we all have to perceive our world and try to filter out what is normal according to what we've learned and been taught and what is not normal in terms of people's affect, behavior, disposition, external appearance, anything that we're perceiving. And when we're not aware or informed about what it's like to live that world, our human nature is to form those assumptions, those attributions, those beliefs about people like that. And stigma theory speaks to it's that lack of knowledge about the lived experience that creates the causes for stigma to build, because if it goes unchecked, those beliefs turn into big beliefs and prejudices. And if that goes unchecked, those beliefs turn into self-sanctioned behaviors. So I do research in stigma, and it's one thing to say, I know what research on stigma is. It's another to live it. And I'll share a quick experience. I was at a conference presenting on stigma, of all things, and downtown Pittsburgh. And I was running. And I noticed that there was a gentleman in front of me behaving in ways that were not what I would consider normal. My perception, my visual perception, was that something was different. And it was a kind of a movement that I wasn't familiar with. And I watched as I was this white woman, mental health researcher, professional. I watched myself walk through stigma formation in the moment. And I saw myself, and I am getting chills and not good ones thinking about it. I saw myself cross the street. And that kept me going, and I kept running. And then I came around a corner And there was the individual, and we were both at a stoplight. And I was right next to him, right next to my own implicit bias. And the idea of not being safe, or if you're close to someone who is not what you have perceived or been taught to perceive as normal, that you are not safe, is the crux, in my belief, of stigma. And I don't know if you guys know this, but former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has been, you know, one of the, on the forefront of this topic, stigma of mental illness, since she began as her career as the First Lady for Jimmy when he was running for governor. And her work on this, if anybody's interested, is incredibly beautiful and interesting. So I see stigma impact every level of what I do. So the fact that we're not integrating more curriculum about mental illness and stigma formation, we need to. This is part of the solutions that I think we could have, but I'm, because you guys are so experienced, please tell us how you see stigma play out in your professional role.
I could probably talk about this for so long because I have people sitting across from me every single day who have even have gone so far to internalize.
Yes.
What should and shouldn't be after giving birth and things like that. And it reminds me of a client that I recently was talking with, and she had been experiencing postpartum rage for a long time. And, you know, she told me, she said, I told my OB, I told him at my 6-week appointment that I wanted to just run my car into a wall and scream at, I was screaming at everyone that I came across. And she told me that her OB-GYN looked at her and said, I don't have resources for you. And if you tell me anymore, I'm not sure where to send you. I don't want to separate you from your baby. And these are the types of stories that I hear all the time. I hear stories about providers not knowing what to do or what to say. And I share that in as a very specific example of the way that stigma has played out for so many people, is that if our babies are doing fine, if our babies are doing well, if our babies are thriving, then therefore, you know, we must be okay. But there's this also, this is another stigma that I hear all the time that goes all the way into being internalized into my clients, is that if I'm suffering, I'm not going to be able to be a good mom. If there is something wrong with me, I'm not going to be able to show up for my child. And then the fear that's associated with that. And so on a very specific level, I think we have to, there is so much stigma related to mental health. Going even into the birth prep courses, I've taken many of them. I've studied many of them. And really, in most of them, there aren't any discussion of what's normal and what might be clinical and what might need help, like when to reach out for help, particularly even for partners of women who are going through the transition into motherhood. And so to me, even the lack of conversation highlights the stigma that is surrounded, especially in the realm of maternal mental illness.
Yes, thank you. Kelly, can you talk a little bit about stigma?
Yeah, this has been a beautiful conversation so far. Thanks. I mean, stigma is so present in the populations that I have served. I think from a feminist perspective, labels such as crazy, hysterical, emotional, have often been placed on women to silence or dismiss their voices. And so I think there's a real fear and oppression when a woman decides to seek mental health care, what that means, right? Mm-hmm. And how she might be perceived. and what impact that might have, whether on their relationships or career or employment. So there's a need for perhaps greater mental health literacy on sort of what to expect in treatment and empowerment for women in treatment. The other thing that comes to mind is my work has primarily centered with addictions. There's a deep, deep shame that goes along with that. And a lot of the women that I was working with had significant sexual traumas that were also parents and that were also with severe addictions. And the sense of shame of, you know, like, I don't deserve to get better. I don't deserve to be with my children. I don't deserve to work towards recovery. I think it's that stigma that has been so internalized. And I think that's really, really awful. And I think that's also why having more women in mental health to treat those specific needs is so important, because recovery is possible and they are absolutely worthy of getting better. And even an understanding of addiction and that it's not all just like their fault. You know what I mean? That there's a biological basis, that there is a vulnerability model as well. Just providing framework to that to facilitate understanding. So yeah, those are a few things that come to mind.
Thank you so much. Shayla, would you like to share something that we've talked about?
I saw Dr. Hamilton unmute. So Dr. Hamilton, if you want to go first, and then I'll wrap up.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things, well, first I concur with Elizabeth. And one of the things I just wanted to mention when you were sharing your work with your client about not having resources. I mean, it's that breaks my heart because it's the 21st century. And for people not to have a resource list or a guide that you can point people to, I think is sad. And it's malpractice, really. But it's also assuming that because a woman is pregnant, it's the best time of her life, and everything is happy, but it's not like that for everyone. It is not. And so having those resources, having people that they can talk to before and after and during, I think is something that all OBGYNs should have. I mean, I'm not happy about that. That makes me really sad that happened, especially to her, your client. But one thing that I wanted to share with you, I remember graduating from my master's program many years ago, and one of my first jobs was in a mental health center. And so here I am, 24 years old. I'm ready to help people. I'm ready to work with people. I want to make people better. That's what I'm thinking in my mind, and not, you know, understanding that there is a process and that the person plays a major role in their health. But one of the things that I saw, and I'm continually to see, and which is why I'm making this point, is that some of the women that came through the doors in that mental health center, the clinicians, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the nurses, whomever, one of the things that they did was automatically assume that the woman was depressed. The woman, she's writing bad checks. She's neglecting the child. She's drinking too much. She's depressed. That was the first diagnosis given to the woman. Hmm. And I saw that. And as a young counselor in training, it blew my mind. I said, well, is this the case for everybody? I mean, could they not have schizophrenia? Could they not have an adjustment disorder? I mean, it just really was a label placed because it was like a placeholder until I really find out what's wrong with her, or until she does something else and I discover that there's something else going on. But whatever it is, I can give her antidepressants and I can say that she's depressed and she will get better. So to me, that's that labeling, that stigma of this is you know, this woman is probably depressed. That's number one. To me, that takes away so much of what could be going on for her and people not understanding. And so to me, that was, it really helped open my eyes. And as a trainee and going forward, I still see some of that, but at the same time, I can look for other things because I know what people did before me. Mm-hmm. So that helped me in some sense. I want to say that it did, but that stigma of only thinking that she can be one way or she can only have this diagnosis to me does is a disservice greatly for women. And so I just wanted to share that. But I enjoy the conversation because it's so important and it makes my heart pound because we experience some of the same things and we want the best for our clients. And when we think about what's happening, it is disheartening, but I think we're taking steps to better that. And that to me makes me happy.
Thank you so much for bringing up that example of, you know, what label we put first. And I know any clinician on this panel, if I say, what are some of the diagnoses that we would consider for children early? My clinical training was with what was labeled severely emotionally disturbed children, ages 3 to 6. And you bet your bippy that the first label that was put on that kid had to do with attachment disorder. Attachment to who? Mom, mostly, or primary caregiver. So right in there, we look at, you know, Dr. Hamilton sharing that there's got to be something wrong, and it might, let's start with one label for mom or for a woman, and it's depression. And I think it's depression because historically, depression has been the most recognized socially and theoretically all the way back to the idea of melancholy and Hippocrates thinking that, you know, our wombs were getting up and wandering around inside of us and causing some sort of disturbance in our levels. So thank you for bringing up an example of a label that is used and how we need some of the labels in order to be able to treat accurately, but they can be so wrong and they can be damaging because, for example, just one really quick thing in bipolar disorder, which is childbirth's a common trigger for bipolar disorder onset if mom has pre-existing condition or previous family history. And the first line of psychopharmacology for a mom is often an antidepressant, which actually, if she has underlying bipolar disorder, it exacerbates those symptoms. So the label is not always the best. Shayla, thank you for your patience. Well, I got a little diatribe in there. Talk to us about stigma.
I agree with everything that's been said so far. And I think the only thing I would add is the combination of the lack of resources and the labeling. And so when I've worked with women in mental health arenas, you know, there's this label of, oh, but I'm not this, right? Or this is the label I've been given before, but I'm not that because of the stigma associated with that, right? Oh, people thought I'm bipolar, but I'm not that because I'm not that bad, right? So trying to distance from this negative stereotyping and then kind of tying back to what we said before, especially with what Dr. Miller was saying, that lack of resources. I feel like in my experience, while it's not necessarily spoken, but I think a lot of women feel that there aren't a lot of resources for us or not a lot of safe spaces for us to. And so is that, once again, that comparative, oh, well, somebody else is worse. So maybe I shouldn't seek that therapy because I'm holding the spot from somebody else who's going through worse. And I think that just really speaks to the perception or the stigma of the availability of mental health resources, what they are used for, the different levels of severity, how to access them, when to access them, I've seen some who have, you know, waited, quote unquote, to the last minute, you know, trying to wait and wait and wait, where if they had had more of those preventative or more of that secondary levels of intervention while it's going on, it would not have gotten to the extremity. But because of the stigma of what does it mean for me to be a woman seeking out these services? Well, is this as bad as what it could be? Or am I taking away from somebody else? Or I don't want that label. And I think all of that really goes into a woman's decision from my experience about if and when and what services to ask for and how to seek that help and that support.
And can a superwoman have the need for those services?
Exactly.
You know, back to the superwoman. I don't think we're quite there yet, even though we all know those superwomen who are handling a wide spectrum of challenges, differences. And we haven't even touched on learning differences. You know, we've kind of stayed within the clinical about mood disorder. And you're right, the label and the resources. Speaking of resources, I just wanted to give an FYI, and then we're going to talk a little bit about solutions before we turn it over to the attendees. Right now, as an example of where the break in the system is with access to resources, consider that ACOG, okay, has no mandate for their doctors to screen for mood or anxiety disorders during pregnancy. It's suggested, strongly suggested, that, you know, maybe three times you will ask a woman how she's feeling, but we've got this down to a science literally as to what kinds of instruments we can ask. And if it's not mandated, no fault against it, you know, the clinicians trying to do the job of a psychiatrist and a OBGYN and a nutritionist and a counselor. So the system is definitely part of what needs to be changed. Along those lines, what are some solutions, guys? And think about how those solutions might generate some questions from the participants. So Kelly, I'm wondering if you could share some ideas for solutions.
No pressure. I think, you know, kind of tying some things back, being able to provide services to women where they're at, I think is super important. And I do see us making some closer steps to that. So I'd mentioned telehealth. The other thing that's been really cool to see is having more integrated care practices. Prior to being at Saybrook, I was faculty in family medicine and doing a lot of integrated primary care work. And so if a woman goes to see her general practitioner for a checkup, are they also screening for depression or anxiety? Are they also checking in about their social emotional health in those checkups? And that's where you can really reach a lot more women. So being able to have not only the screening on site in those medical settings, but also, okay, thank you for sharing that with me. And, you know, either I can address some of that here with you today, or I have somebody on site that I'd like to connect you with that can also, you know, take this to the next step in terms of helping you. I think we can reach a lot more women. So I'm heartened to see us advancing in those ways. And then the third area, we have most universities have university counseling centers where college students can receive mental health counseling. We're now seeing that also starting to be in some school districts. So having integrated high school healthcare of both medical and mental health. So I think especially during that period of adolescence where we do start to see at the onset of symptoms, the better that we can do at early intervention, we can do so much to empower young girls and women to be able to cope, to be able to plan, and to be able to live full and rich, rewarding lives. So those are a few things that come to mind for me.
Exactly. And what comes to mind, Kelly, is the reproductive life plan from public health, you know, maternal fetal public health. This idea that we start early by giving education to everyone, and I mean early. So we can imagine a pediatrician doing some psychoeducation with a young person about these issues. Mm-hmm. So that as across their lifespan, and because we know that all human beings have the most touch points with care providers around reproduction, that it will give them the voice and the language to be able to say, I need to also talk to you about my family's history of depression.
Yeah.
So other solutions that we can consider. Elizabeth, what are your thoughts?
Think of this as kind of an umbrella, you know, on the big picture, the schools. You know, I was a school counselor. I'm a licensed school counselor here in Texas. And where I live in Houston, most schools have no school counseling. There's no school counselor. And if there is, they're typically helping kids graduate. That's their focus. And so for me, in the big picture, I'd love to start when kids are young, really infusing our curriculum with socio-emotional tools and skills, things that are as easy as teaching kids how to regulate their own nervous system, regulate their own experiences so that they can, you know, if they're experiencing anxiety before a test, you know, they can breathe and they can learn just specific tools to help them get through their day. So that's a big overarching umbrella. More specifically, bringing social emotional tools into our home, reading books with our kids that normalize the full spectrum of emotion and how we can talk, giving verbiage and words to our experience so that we can communicate to the adults in our life what we're experiencing and what we're going through. And modeling the behavior of what it looks like as a mother, you know, I recently had a conversation with my husband and I have two daughters. And he said, look, you are so busy, all of these things. You need to work on modeling for our children, our daughters, what it means to say no and what it means to say yes. So that they, when they grow up, structure their life to work for them and that they're not stretched thin. But then on an even more, you know, specific level, we need to heal our own trauma as women. We need to heal our own trauma so that when we're interacting with the world, we're interacting with the world from a place of empowerment instead of trauma. Hmm. And so I think if we can do all three of those levels, I think we have a solid chance of moving this in a healthier direction for my daughter's generation and for generations to come.
Absolutely. And I just want to jump in there, Dr. Miller. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. We have to heal our traumas. And just when Dr. Ladd opened about an hour ago, I think, she mentioned the statistics of 1 in 5 women. Was that 1 in 5 women was diagnosed? What about the people who aren't diagnosed? What about those are the folks I'm thinking about right now? I can't heal myself if I don't know that I have a trauma or I have an unresolved issue or that I have triggers that I don't know how to deal with or react to. I don't know. So, I agree with you. I think that training starts young, starts at the grade level because we know 99% of children will be in school somewhere at, you know, most in the United States. Globally, it's different, of course. But so if we look at the United States, we know that we can catch them there. We know that we can catch them with a pediatrician. That's if they're going to a pediatrician. We're looking at middle class and on up. Sometimes people don't have the resources for that. Sometimes caregivers don't have the opportunities to get off work to take their kids unless there's something happening like a broken leg or something like that. So we have to be mindful of these things and understand that, and I think someone said it earlier, that we have to meet our clients where they are when they come to us, because not everyone's going to get that holistic health part of their lives from when they're a baby until they're an adult. It just doesn't happen for all of us at the same rate. And so, but I agree. I think that it starts young. I do want to share when my daughter was in the 6th grade in middle school, She came home so excited about the Kindness Club. And I said, what? And she says, I've been asked to participate in the Kindness Club. And I said, what does that mean? And so, and what it meant is to write notes to the elementary age students and kids and encourage them. And so that was something that, we teach them, but that was a different part of learning for her to give back to someone younger than she. And so she was so happy about that. So I embraced the school for doing that, because that was not something that I did 30 years ago when I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, 35 years ago when I was school. I don't want to age myself, but truly and honestly, it was surprising to see. And I like that part of it. I think that's something that, if we can work with our young children and make sure they get the confidence and the empowerment, it will help them when they come across things, because it will happen. And the trauma can be no fault of their own. It could be a loved one that passed away. One of my daughters, I have two daughters too, Dr. Miller, and when a grandparent passed away, she was so upset and we couldn't understand. And then she shared with us that she prayed for her grandmother to live, and that didn't happen. And she was angry. She was really angry. So we had to process that, but we had no idea what was going on for her. We didn't know that was we just didn't know until she shared it with us and we asked her to. But if that was unresolved and she grew up and didn't ever deal with that, I could see that would impact who she becomes as a woman, as a mother, as a sister, as a cousin or a daughter. So, I just think that the abuse, the trauma, the body image, living and working, all of these things encompass who we are. Healing from those, it's just powerful. But how can we heal if people are not ready or don't even see that they need healing? That's the question that often comes to mind for me all the time. Everyone's walking around with some trauma, and it may be a different trauma, but we have something that didn't go right and we're not done dealing with it, let's just say.
Yeah.
But I think that the solutions are out there if we can take them and if we can get to them.
Absolutely. I agree, and I know we're going to turn now, guys who are attending, if you'd like to start to think about your questions, put them in the chat, and I'm going to talk a little bit, hand it over to Shayla for her quick ideas on solutions. And I want to say that part of the solution is in making sure in our institutions where we're teaching people to be clinicians and we're teaching people to love each other, that we're teaching people about stigma formation, that in our curriculum, we're talking about mental illness across the lifespan, and that we do due diligence to the one thing we all have in common, we come from a mother, and where is she in our curriculum, and our policy, and our advocacy. So that's my little last moment there. I think as people start to put their questions or raise their hands, Shayla, did you have any quick thoughts about solutions?
Yeah, what do you add to that? I mean, just being such a part of this powerful panel with these strong women, what do I add? I mean, we talked about potential systemic solutions. We talked about what to do in our homes and how we model and teach our children that behavior. We talked about the personal healing. We talked about teaching and, thinking about who's accessing this trauma and who doesn't, or who's accessing the services and who doesn't. And so I think the last piece that I would encourage all of us to do is, of course, go back to what is the space that we hold. And I know, in some ways, I think back to years ago when I was a teenager and I would watch Tyra Banks. They say, oh, you're so beautiful. She's like, girl, this is weed. This ain't my hair, or this is my makeup, and just being honest. And so I know There's not a lot of people who look like me in the spaces that I hold. I was a social worker at 24 with my master's. I was a clinician at 27. I was a tenure track professor at 28. At 30, I'm beginning my doctoral program. There's not a lot of people who look like me who advance that quickly. And I've had clients, excuse my language, but I have one teenage, beautiful Black woman who said, Shaylee, you're just a bad bitch. And, you know, I've had students who respond and say, I want to be like you. You give me something to look forward to. You are, you know, a professor who looks like me with an afro and a nose ring. And so when they see these images of me, it is now my responsibility to say, but this is how I got here. And yes, you see my successes, but I also have my difficulties. And in the right context, of course, you know, if my client says that, I'm not going to be like, oh, let me tell you what, how I got here and my troubles. But it's important for me to share that, yes, I can be a superhero, but I can also need other supports. And there are things that I want to strengthen. And so I think really sharing our stories and how we achieved normalizes and validates and gives space for us to talk about what are some of the things, what are the stigmas that we address as we get here. So I think that's what I would add.
Thank you. There are two great questions in the chat. Jamie Kellaway wants to know, Dr. Hamilton just mentioned body image. Oh, we haven't even started, have we? We haven't even, oh my gosh. I wonder if anyone has something they might like to add to that. Yeah, 27 years of therapy, I'd like to add to that. As an ex-dancer. Oh, Jamie, thank you for the question. Panelists, any quick ideas about the intersection of body image?
You know, can I say something to add?
Of course.
Walker, this weekend, you know, I try to involve my daughter with as I call them, my golden girlfriends, because, you know, we all have that wisdom. So one of my friends said that to battle body image challenges, she looks in the mirror every morning and picks out one thing she likes about herself. And then there's one of my other golden girlfriends. She said, girl, if I do that, I'm going to be there all day. She's like 80. And I thought that was so profound because, you know, she's telling my little girl, she said, hey, you guys, she said, I love everything I see. And I thought that was so cool. Mm. So now we got to do that.
Yes. Yes. And the stick. Yes. Body.
That was so
Thank
good.
You.
I had to share that.
Others with this intersection of life experience and body image. Oh my goodness, it's so big.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the reasons why I mentioned that, and Carmen, that was a lovely story. I mean, gosh, that's
so
cute. So
beautiful.
But I think the positive affirmation should be said every single day. We should say it at 50, at 75, at 20, at 15. And we should teach people to say that because love starts within. If you can't love yourself, I don't know how you can help people and how you can love others. You have to love yourself. And we can teach that in counseling, and we do teach that in counseling. But I think that when we talk about body image, you're right. It encompasses so much. And for me, I think about the day and time that we're in with advertisements and marketing and the sexualized, the hypersexual, you know, all these things happening and young girls looking at these things saying that this is what's pretty, this is what's acceptable, and I have to be this way. And if I'm not, then, you know, I don't feel good about myself.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna get a person that I want. Or, you know, we learn that earlier on. And I think that we have to reprogram, and we have to say, accept ourselves for who we are and how we are. And it's all right. But it's not an easy thing. And it's not easy to tell a 13, 14 year old child that. It really isn't. Especially when they're seeing so much. You have the cell phones, the computers, you have flyers, beautiful flyers. You have TV and movies. You have all of these things. Yeah. And I'm not saying that to blame that on what people do with eating disorders or body image. It certainly influences them and I think adds to it. Confidence, self-esteem certainly is in within, and it grows. So, but I definitely think that they are all connected. And one of the things when I was working with children, we would always teach them those positive affirmations. And like Carmen said, to look at yourself and see and say what it is that you're happy about and what you know that, you know, because we have to say those things out loud because somebody might not ever say it to you. So having high self-esteem, good self-confidence, I think can help with some of those things. But Dr. Ladd, you mentioned sports. I mean, I tell you, I mean, that's a big part of it too. I was a former athlete too, and I can tell you it's not an easy thing to compete and watch what you eat and lift weights and train and condition and to keep your weight down or keep your weight up. It's a struggle and it takes a toll on you psychologically. And I don't know what the best answer for that is. I know that it's connected. Oh, please.
I just want to say that I think that this is one intersection that we can open up to everyone. That the intersection, the crossover space of physical appearance and mental health are hand in hand. And also age. I feel so, maybe because I'm getting older, the older we get, the more invisible people who are past 50 are. So, and still, there is an intersection of our body and how we feel that we're perceived by society. Again, there you are in being perceived for, and in terms of images and technology, we all have access to this. We can use that as part of the solution for anyone, trans or cis. I mean, it goes across the spectrum. Yeah. I want to make sure that I check quick question coming in. Anyone want to, from Margan, any questions that or thoughts you guys have about family systems in supporting women, family systems theory in supporting women? And helping address stigma because it comes to questions of therapy and pathology from a slightly different approach. Uh-huh. So the identified patient. Margan, did you want to chime in or ask one, add on to that?
Really, it was just kind of that. I was curious about other people's thoughts because having worked in marriage and family therapy eons ago, because I'm even older than you, I've seen so many shifts over the last couple of decades and even the way family systems from when it was first, from its inception to the way it's practiced now. But that idea of identified patient. And so if we're talking about women and stigma, childbirth, whatever, you can't really take a woman out of her system, particularly if we're talking about motherhood. We're talking about what do we bring with us from the past, from our own families of origin, from our, you know, our internalized concepts of self. And I think family systems comes to this in a very different way sometimes than like individually oriented psychotherapy and clinical psychology does. But I don't see a lot of it in practice anymore.
Great question. Anybody from the panel? I was trained in family systems, and I agree. I don't see it as much. Anybody want to talk about that?
Did we get Elena's question, Walker?
I'm sorry, Carmen, say that again.
Did we get Elena Gillespie's question? I'm not sure if we answered it yet.
I don't see it. What was it?
It's from 212, and it says, this has been the worst term in terms of the pandemic by far.
Yeah, I don't see it.
Okay, it says I've got
to try to answer. I see Elena's question, and
okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay. So Elena's question was, this has been the worst term in terms of pandemic by far. I've got students, women in particular, who are under serious stress. What have we got that we can do for them specifically now? I'm happy to kind of infuse a little bit of both of those questions maybe. And I don't know if this, Margan, is exactly what you're looking for, but as everyone has been talking, something that just keeps triggering for me is the shoulds that are on women, the shoulds from the media, the shoulds from our families, the shoulds from even in terms of, you know, how big or small our bodies are supposed to be, what they're supposed to look like, how we're supposed to be professionals, how we're supposed to be mothers. And in terms of this, the role, I think the important thing here is that there are shoulds coming from every single direction. And I think for women, it can be really, really difficult to decipher which are the things that are internally, intrinsically, intuitively part of us and the things that we want to participate in, and the shoulds from the external world. And I will say, in terms of the cross-section of mental health and women, the concept of all of these shoulds is something that has to be talked about. Because if we are not aware of all of these messages coming from all these different places, we're not going to be able to sit with them, be with them, and decipher which ones we want to actually practice. And so in terms of maybe the family and the roles that we play in our family, I think it's important that all of these messages that are coming, that we're able to become aware and change the systems that we're in, by using our voice and by highlighting other women's voices, and by doing so, standing up for what we really believe in, instead of just jumping on the bandwagon and telling our daughters, well, don't eat that much, or don't do this in terms of body language, or not body language, but body size and things like that. Okay. So I think there's a lot of room for change, and I think there's a lot of room for self-compassion, but also first awareness.
Thank you. And I know we're reaching the end of our time, and it's time to kind of wrap up. Thank you for the questions. I put a couple of resources in the chat. Something that I think we could all share is the suicidepreventionlifeline.org. If you're not aware of them, they've got free downloadable information, but also you can use their social media to put on your own materials. If you've got a website, if you, I don't know, have a college or a university, you could upload this and have it on the website. I also put in there the link to the National Institutes for Mental Health, Help for Mental Illnesses. They've got the similar resources there. I just wanted to make sure that these two resources got into your hands before we wrapped up today. Finally, I want to thank the panelists who have come and shared such rich information, experience, and heart. And lastly, to thank Carmen and Shanice for helping us put this important panel together. And little known fact, today is World Bipolar Disorder Awareness Day. So take that fact with you. And Carmen, is there anything you would need to share with the attendees?
Well, I just want to thank everyone for coming. I've put in the chat all the links that Walker shared. And if you access that, it has all the hyperlinks to everything that she has so that you can use it later, and feel free to share it. Also, we're going to, if you want to share this recording with someone else, we'll have that, we'll send that out to you once we've gotten it all together in the next couple of days. But I, you know, mental health is near and dear to my heart, and this was such an important panel, and certainly we'd like to do something similar in the near future. So keep your eyes and ears open for something great to happen. But we appreciate your time today, and to the panelists, bravo, bravo, and thank you for bestowing upon us all of your wisdom and knowledge. And
as we know, there's so much more in the mental health realm to discuss. So stay
tuned.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.